All right. What is going on, everybody? It is time for the Friday, July 12th edition of SaberSim's DFS Office Hours. My name's Jordan. I'm the head coach here at SaberSim, and it is a balmy 102 degrees here in Denver today. My swamp cooler is losing the fight, so we're trying to stay cool here under the bright lights of Office Hours. I've got my water bottle here. We're going to stay hydrated. We're going to pace ourselves a little bit here, make sure we're taking a couple water breaks here, staying cool. It seems like it's hot everywhere in the middle of the country, but some storms threatening our baseball slate here on the East Coast today as well. Kind of my nightmare scenario for weather on Kevin Roth's dashboard. He's got three games with my least favorite color designation, which is yellow-orange. Those ones always drive me crazy because it doesn't feel like there's a ton of postponement risk, but there's just enough to make me feel a little nervous about it here. So anyway, if this is your first time tuning into Office Hours, this is an open Q&A show. Ask your questions into the YouTube chat. Fire them into the x.com chat if you're watching over there. You can also ask in the Office Hours channel in Discord. Whatever you guys want to talk about, whether it's DFS strategy, whether it's SaberSim stuff, whatever floats your boat. We do have quite a few questions in our queue here already for today. We've got a lot to get into, so I want to dive right in pretty quickly here. And we'll go ahead and kick things off. I'm actually going to bounce around just a tad because I think this is a fun question and a relevant question here for today to get things started with. This is from Sammy, and it is about WNBA. So let me actually bounce over to WNBA here first. And the reason I think this is relevant is we have a pretty cool WNBA slate here. I'll refresh to get the correct logos there. If you ever see those incorrect logos load when you are opening up WNBA, we don't have projections yet. So our projections guys will probably get those up here in the next couple hours. So maybe we'll back up to yesterday's slate as an example. But if you ever open up WNBA and you're not seeing the correct logos up here, two things. One, first, fear not. It doesn't affect your builds whatsoever. It is just a caching bug that we're working on fixing. If you hit that with a refresh, you'll get the correct logos showing up. It is pretty funny to see like the White Sox logo show up as the Aces logo or something like that. But it is just a visual caching bug that we're working on fixing here. But the reason I do want to talk about a WNBA question here to get things started is we have some fun contests. We have a 20K to first flagship for WNBA today. I think it's like 5,000 entries in that contest, a 150 max. But also the high stakes are pretty fun. There is a $333 15 max. Probably won't be playing 15 in there in my case, but it is a 50K to first. I think it's the biggest WNBA contest this season so far. They might have done a 100K to first, like on opening night or in the first week, maybe. I don't think so. I think this is at least probably the biggest WNBA contest this season. So pretty exciting stuff. Let's talk about this. This is from Sammy here. What's the best use for randomness for WNBA for the optimizer? I am going to back up to yesterday's slate here for WNBA. It was just a showdown yesterday. Maybe we can go back. We'll go back a couple days. So not perfect here. We're backing up a few days because we don't have the projections loaded just yet for WNBA here. So we'll back up to a slate where we had the projections here and just kind of talk about the randomness settings. Because right now we are only doing projections on WNBA. We're not doing full sims. We're not doing ownership. You are going to be using optimizer mode. So you're just going to be optimizing generally kind of like the same way a traditional optimizer would here. I do think there's still a ton of edge in these projections, particularly because the team behind these projections is putting a ton of work into it. The way that they are building these projections out is really cool. They are actually doing like a minutes by minutes. It's not a true sim, but it is like this five is up against this five on the court minute by minute. And that's how this affects the rates. So tracking like the defensive matchups and also who's on the court. I did an interview on our YouTube channel a couple weeks ago here with the team that is, or with Matt, who's working on these WNBA projections for us here. I can't remember if it was actually streamed live or not. Let's just search WNBA on the YouTube channel. But if you're playing WNBA and want to learn more about the projections, there they are right here. So yeah, it was a live stream. So it'll be in the live section. But this video right here, I did with Matt, who's working on these projections. And you can just listen to how they are put together here for 56 minutes and 55 seconds. Really, really strong video. Matt is super sharp. got me really excited about the WNBA projections. So if you want to learn more about them here, you can watch that video. But let's talk about the randomness settings here, mostly because the randomness settings are going to be what is the main tool you have at your disposal to get different types of lineups and introduce a little bit of variance here. If you just hit build, default projections, build your lineups, your top 20 lineups, or your top 150 are going to be the same that everybody else sees, right? So we talked yesterday on Office Hours about some ways that you could circumvent that. I mentioned one thing that I've been liking to do is, you know, maybe eliminating the top 20 or so lineups intentionally so I don't dupe another SaberSim user and picking lineups that are a little bit further down. You can also use randomness here as a way to introduce a little bit of variance. Fortunately, because basketball is one of the more normally distributed sports out there, randomness is actually going to work pretty decently for getting the ranges of outcomes of players. It's not going to account for correlations in the way that a simulation does. So in our NBA simulations, for example, not only are we sampling from a realistic range of outcomes of each player, which will look like a bell curve, but they're also sampling individual games. So if you're getting, you know, if you're getting LeBron James in a lineup in NBA, you might be a little bit less likely to get Anthony Davis because those two players, it's harder for them to reach their peak upside in the same game. That part is not going to be accounted for perfectly here, but randomness is going to do a good job of assessing the range of outcomes here because these players are going to tend towards normal distributions, and that's how the randomness settings are going to work, at least some of them here. So let's talk about what the randomness settings do first, because I think these can be a little bit confusing. It's good to just have an understanding of how these work here. So the uniform distribution here, and the tooltips are written pretty well, so they are very helpful. This is basically just going to kind of create a flat possible set of outcomes here around a range of that player's projection. So for example, if you set this at 10%, it's going to say each time you build your lineup, is it Aja Wilson? Asia Wilson? I don't watch enough WNBA to know for sure, but her range of outcomes is going to be between 5.4 under 54 and 5.4 above 54. That's how the uniform randomness works here. And that is a flat distribution. So like any outcome within that range can be selected equally as likely as any others. And every player in the pool would have that same distribution. And I actually tend to lean away from the uniform distribution, I think, because the normal distributions are going to work a little bit better here. There are three normal distribution options here. I personally think the most useful one for WNBA is going to be global. SaberSim honestly should be disabled. It won't do anything. What SaberSim does is it would use the SaberSim standard deviations for players if we had them. So really what SaberSim normal randomness is if you took a sport where we had a simulation for, like NBA, and you wanted to use it like a traditional optimizer. Honestly, I don't know why you would ever want to do that, to be quite honest, but it is there if you want it. It would use the SaberSim standard deviations to build out a normal distribution around the player. Won't work for WNBA, so be aware of that. And honestly, it probably should just be disabled since there are no SaberSim standard deviations. You don't want to click that one. Custom, this could be pretty cool. And maybe if you're a grinder and you're pretty deep in the WNBA streets, maybe have something kind of resembling your own model here. This is a way you could set standard deviations if you had uploaded them as custom data. So if you had gone in here and you had, you know, uploaded standard deviations as like custom data here, I actually don't even have anything to upload here, but you know, maybe a standard deviation of 14.7 or something like that. You had these for all players. You could designate that as a standard deviation to be used to make a distribution using this custom field here. We're not going to do that either, or I wouldn't recommend it. I recommend using the global. And what global is going to do is you are setting a percentage of that player's projection to use as that player's standard deviation. This is the one that I think is the most effective. I think you're going to probably get the best results using this here. So it's kind of similar to the way that uniform works, but instead we're building out a realistic normal distribution around a player's range of outcomes instead of just creating this kind of block of possible outcomes. So when you go to global, if we set this to 10%, for example, we are saying each player's standard deviation is 10% of their projection. And then we are using the mean. And using the standard deviation, we can build a bell curve around that player. The wider the standard deviation, the wider that curve would be, and it is centered around the mean projection for every player. In terms of what you should actually set this number to, there's some complexity here. And I don't think there's a perfectly right answer when we're thinking about this uniformly. What you will find if you are looking at standard deviations of players for NBA, for example, which I think is a good corollary here to use to think about this, is the higher a player's projection is, the lower their standard deviation is relative to that projection. So higher projected players, their standard deviation is a lower percentage of their projection. Their ranges of outcomes are more narrow relative to the projection. Lower projected players have a wider range of outcomes relative to the projection. And that makes a lot of sense if you think about it intuitively in kind of basketball terms, right? A top-end player, first of all, they're going to be on the court, barring an injury, barring foul trouble, barring these, like, you know, somewhat outlier outcomes. They are going to get their minutes. They're going to be playing. There's also a limited potential ceiling of what they can actually achieve, right? Like a player that doesn't play a lot of minutes can be thrust into a higher usage role all of a sudden in the middle of a game or shoot particularly well. There is more potential ceiling unlockable to that player. But players are not going to go out and, again, I'm kind of using NBA terms, but a player's not going to go out very often and score 80 points or something like that, right? 80 real-life basketball points. Those extreme ceilings are a little more limited for those top-end players. So their outcomes are a little more narrow. On the flip side, a player that is projected for 13 points can play 30. Like, that could happen. That is feasible. That's actually, minutes is probably a better way of thinking about this. It's, nobody can play 50 minutes. Nobody can play 42 minutes in a WNBA game here, right? So there's a little bit of locked top-end ceiling for the top projected players. At the bottom end, that doesn't exist to the same extent. And their outcomes also can drop through the floor, right? There's not going to be really a situation, again, barring injury, extreme foul trouble, something weird, where Caitlin Clark plays like 5 minutes. But if you scroll down, you get to the bottom here, you get to these low projected players, right? Even some of these players, you know, in this range might have that kind of outcome potential. So all this to say, standard deviations as a percentage of a player's projection are higher at the bottom end, lower at the top end. So where does this kind of all shake out? When I have been experimenting with this, I have been playing with randomness percentages for standard deviations, I would say between 15 and 25%. And where that comes from is that is kind of the range that I see standard deviations about in NBA between the top end and the bottom end, maybe 10 to 25%. And I'm leaning on a little bit of the higher side of that because I'm comfortable introducing variance into my builds, right? I think that's good. It's going to diversify you against the field. It's going to diversify you against your portfolio. I'm like comfortable playing with a little bit of a higher variance because we don't have the Sims doing that for us in our process. So let's experiment with like 20 or so. And again, the other thing that's a little bit strange about using these randomness settings is there's not really like a great way to visually see what it's actually doing. Like, you hit save here and then it kind of just is working. Like, then when you go to build your build, it's doing the thing. There's not really a way to see what the calculated standard deviations are or see the curves that are created for players. Like, it would be kind of cool if you could then click on, you know, Caitlin Clark or something like that and then see the distribution that had been created. Maybe at some point, honestly, optimizer mode is a little bit more of a niche feature on SaberSim. It's not something we use a lot. It's not something we recommend a lot. So kind of a niche use here for WNBA, but that is how it works. That's what it's doing. So the other thing that's nice about the randomness settings is the builds end up running quite a bit faster because now we're sampling from a distribution instead of trying to brute force solve the optimal. So your builds will run a little bit faster if you're building out 150. If you're building out a big pool of lineups, you're going to be able to build those a little bit faster. But that is how it works, and that is kind of how I recommend using it. So to sum up, if you're just looking for the answers to the test here rather than all the extra stuff going on behind the scenes, I like the idea of using a normal distribution. I think it's going to be a lot more accurate than a uniform distribution. Using a global option here for the second option, mostly because it's our only choice, unless you have your own standard deviations. And then somewhere between, I would probably say 10 to 25% is probably where you want to be. And I think another thing to keep in mind is the higher this number is, the more incorrectly you are assessing the top end players' ranges of outcomes, the lower it is, the more incorrectly you're assessing the bottom end players' ranges of outcomes, right? And for me personally, I would probably prefer to be a little bit wrong on the top end and be a little bit extra diversified on the top end, because those players are projected so well that they're going to show up in your lineups anyway, right? Like the opportunity cost, like we are not going that this high randomness that we just set is not so high that we're suddenly getting lineups that have 48,000 salary, 47,000 salary, right? Like these lineups are still getting filled in with the salary. They're still going to project pretty well relative to the optimal, right? Being a little bit, thinking that the ranges of outcomes of the top end players is a little too wide is a lesser of two evils of thinking that the bottom end players' ranges of outcomes are too narrow from my perspective. So I'm a little more comfortable pumping up that randomness number a little bit higher. I like that 20-25 range. That's kind of where I've been sticking. The last note I'll make on this, and then we'll move on to the next question, is that the other factor is sim diversity slider, which functionally works the same way as randomness does here. When you are, it has a similar effect. That slider moves based on the size of the slate. So we'll raise it for small slates, we'll lower it for big slates. I think there's an argument to increase your randomness setting a little bit more in a smaller slate, like a 2-game slate, than in a big slate. Like we had this 5-game slate a couple days ago here. It's a 3-game slate here tonight. So I would maybe stick around that 20 to 25 range. But if it was a 2-game slate, maybe you're leaning a little more like 25, maybe even 30. If there was another 5-game slate, maybe you're going closer to like 10-15%. So hopefully that's helpful. I think there's a lot to be discovered, for lack of a better word, about the WNBA side of things, just because it's really blown up in popularity this year. We're seeing large field tournaments for the first time. This is a new product for us. And it's working. It works a little bit different than some of the other sports on SaberSim right now. So definitely a lot of room to play around with here. If you have ideas or things, you know, that in your research have popped up about, like, even not even like ball knower research, but about like how to think about these standard deviations and how to use randomness settings, go for it, because I think it's worth experimenting for right now. So our YouTube chat is popping off already. I see a bunch of questions coming in. I do need to get us caught up here on some of the other questions in the Discord first. And I promise I will not spend 20 minutes on every question here today like I just did for this one. So I make sure that we're getting to everybody's questions here. We'll go ahead and go in roughly chronological order from here. I did just want to start with that WNBA question here for today, because the slate is such a big one. So this is from Jay Sams Jr. here. What are some pitcher-friendly parks? Also, what are some hitter-friendly parks that have home run and extra bases potential? I will mention right off the rip here that park factors are something that are totally accounted for in the sims already. So just be aware of that. If you are doing kind of extra work to pump up teams, pump up projections based on park factors, you are to some extent double counting them. If you think that, you know, we are understating a park factor based on what you're seeing in the projections, or we are systemically biased against a certain park or something like that, we do a lot of checks on that to make sure that that's not the case. In the past, we have Miami does come to mind. We did have a bias towards the Miami park historically being a better hitting environment than it was. That was something that we fixed in the offseason heading into this year. It's something that we check on pretty regularly. So these are accounted for in the simulation. So just be aware of that. If you're making changes based on this information, you may be double counting a bit. I would recommend Baseball Savant has a really good page for this. First thing that came up, actually. So using StatCast data, this is, I think, a pretty cool tool. I'm not going to go super deep into this because I do want to make sure I get to everyone's questions today. But if you just want to research this, I think this is a pretty cool way of looking at park factors. I think in particular, the overall park factor that they've kind of created here that is basically trying to assess just hitting strength at large is interesting. You can also look at home run factors in particular if you want to look at those. This, I think, is just a pretty good source. This is also a 3-year average, which I think has pros and cons to that approach. I think you can turn that off and maybe look at everything. Oh, no. Okay. So it's either this year or you can look at the 3-year rolling average. So, and I think that's a StatCast thing. I think that corresponds to when StatCast data became publicly available here. So, but pretty cool to look at. I was poking around on this getting ready for the show today, and I think there were a few interesting things that jumped out to me, just things that surprised me. I was a bit surprised that the Royals play in such a hitting friendly park. obviously some noise in that measurement here for the past 3 years, but I was surprised to see them so high up there. Also, looking at the bottom, I think my intuition of the worst hitting parks would have been that it was the Padres and the Giants. And I was surprised to see that the Mariners and the Mets had worse, and Mariners almost a tear break here in that last park. I found that interesting as well. But I'll let you guys go ahead and dive into this on your own time, experiment with that, take a look, remembering that I think this is mostly for, you know, personal research, maybe almost novelty, knowing that these are accounted for in the sim already, but pretty fun to poke around. The whole run home run data is also kind of interesting too. Dodger Stadium showing up as the second heaviest home run park. My first instinct was that, well, the Dodgers just hit a lot of home runs, but I think this is a bit of a confusing tooltip on the site here. But I think what this is basically saying is that's adjusted for, that they're not saying like that's not just Dodgers hit a lot of home runs, so Dodgers is a good home run park. I think this is implying that that's adjusted for, but I think this is written a little weird, so I'm not totally sure. But anyway, all right, let's keep it rolling here. Next question from Ghost about late swap. Can late swap reduce your post-contest sim ROI, especially if you reduce minimum salary and attempt to really save doomed lineups? This is kind of an interesting question, and I think it depends on when you are measuring that sim ROI, like at what part of the process. So when you run a late swap build, if you think about what your original lineup's ROI is at that point in time in the contest, right? So I'm talking about this from a live standpoint. So say you are late swapping the slate tonight. Are we on the slate? Yeah, we are. And it is, let's say, 7:20. So there's four games left. It is very, and you measure a lineup's ROI, their expected ROI at that point in time, right? So you're using the live data we have from the games that have already started and are in progress, and the live field lineups of the lineups that you are playing, that your opponents are playing. It is very unlikely that a late swap makes your lineups worse from that point on, right? Because what is basically happening is you have a single lineup in play that you chose to play on that slate. Late swap is going to build you, you know, a few dozen more options of what that lineup could become. And the late swap contest sims are going to grade each of those options throughout the remainder of the slate and say, this one is probably the best one to play. So if you have, let me pull in a entries file here. If you have 150 lineups in play, let's see. I'm going to need to fill this entries file here quickly so this can make some actual sense here of what I'm trying to say. I'll keep talking while this is building. I just want to get my entries file full so I can actually kind of show a late swap here. But if you have 150 lineups in play, SaberSim will let you late swap each one of them into 33 new options, because it's basically 5,000 divided by 150 basically means 33 swap options for each original lineup you played. It is likely that one of those 33 is better than the original you played, right? Just pure mathematics there. Like if you're playing one lineup and now I say, well, Would you rather keep the one lineup you already have, or do you want to see 33 new options and pick the best one of that group? It's very likely that one of those 33 is a better option. So in slate, mid slate, it's very unlikely that a late swap will drop your ROI. However, and this is a very important point, if you are studying in contest flashback, it is very likely that a late swap could have the appearance of having made your lineups worse than they were at lock, right? Because at lock, you are building with no information about actually what happens in the slate. So you are playing the best possible lineups given the full possible ranges of outcomes. But you may have, if you think about this from the standpoint of just one lineup, I think it's simpler. Let's say you have one lineup that is very unlikely to cash. Its ROI, its mean ROI halfway through the slate is -50%. Well, you might have a swap that you could make to that lineup that in real time brings that lineup's ROI to -20%. So you're actually winning back a little bit of equity on that lineup. It's a little bit more likely to min cash now, and maybe you've got a chance of sneaking into the cash. But in doing so, you probably dropped that lineup's projection. You probably swapped into some less chalky, less well-projected plays to win back some equity. In the event that chalk fails, you can jump over the cash line, and that lineup ends up making a little bit of money back for you. But that swap will have looked worse in contest flashback because you swapped to a worse lineup. But that's because that was what was most profitable given where the slate was. So a good way to kind of think about this here is you kind of have two different segments of where ROI gets measured. In the middle of a slate, you are reacting to information that you have about what is happening in real life for that slate. But when you build pre-lock and when you build post-lock, or not when you build post-lock, when you look at contest flashback, you're looking at the full range of possible outcomes of what was possible. So in terms of like actionable practical advice here, I would say you should be doing late swaps to react to changing starting lineups. I think you should also be doing a late swap at some point, maybe around the midpoint of the slate, to account for live data, because it is a very powerful, a very useful part of your process. Winning back min cash equity to lineups that are underperforming and maximizing the profitability of lineups that are overperforming is a valuable part of MLB strategy. You should be doing that, but you should be aware that that could actually reduce the ROI when you look in contest flashback, because the way that those ROIs are measured is different. In contest flashback, you're looking at the full range of possible outcomes. When the slate is live and you are late swapping, you are on rails on the one outcome that is actually playing out in reality, right? So good question. I've never actually had the opportunity, I think, to talk about that on a video or a stream. Probably should, because I think that's a very, very a good point to think about and a good point to be aware of. So I would also say, like, another practical takeaway here is if there are slates where it's just like chaos on the slate, like everything's like, we got multiple scratches, a ton of late lineups, maybe a weather postponement, late swaps, just crazy. I think it's actually probably fair to assume that your contest flashback scores might be a little bit lower for that slate, because presumably you're late swapping a ton, and the more you're late swapping, the more each lineup is going to kind of get distanced from what it was at lock and potentially have a lower ROI, right? So, yeah. Yeah, good question. Okay, let's keep rolling. We'll get to YouTube chat here shortly. We're going to keep rolling through Discord because these guys asked their questions first. We'll get to these shortly here. I do see there is a couple questions here about NASCAR trucks. I'm not the right person to ask right at this moment on this stream. I am not going to be able to troubleshoot that. Pop a question into the support channel in Discord. I'm sure our support team will look at it quickly. I don't even know if qualifying's run. Qualifying needs to run first for any NASCAR stuff to run. Trucks and Xfinity, qualifying is the same day as the race, so it's always a little bit of a sprint to get those up. They generally are up an hour before the slate locks. That's all I'm going to be able to do on the show here. Okay. Let's keep it going here. Okay. So from Sammy here, a couple other questions. Is there a way, excuse me, to make some ownership and product ownership work in tandem regardless of the DFS sport? The second part of this question seems to be about the randomness settings, which we just covered extensively at the start of the stream here. So I'm going to skip that, rewind back, 20 or so minutes if you want to check that out. Some ownership, product ownership work in tandem. I'm going to give you full disclosure here before I answer this question and say I don't use those almost ever, period. So I'll give you some ideas here. It's not a cornerstone, or really not even a part of my process at all. I occasionally will use product ownership or geometric mean of ownership for high duped sports as a way to kind of check that work, right? So you can take product ownership. I'll try to give the spark notes here of what a product ownership is trying to do, but you can, in a rough approximation, assess how likely a lineup is to be duped by taking each player's ownership projection and assuming it is the probability of that player being played in the lineup, and assuming that every player being entered in any lineup is an independent event from another player being entered in the lineup, which it's not. It's a bad assumption, but it is an assumption baked into this. Multiplying all of the ownerships of a lineup together, and then multiplying that by the number of players that are in your lineup or that are in your contest, that will roughly approximate how likely that lineup is to be duped. There are issues with that calculation, but it is a rough approximation of how likely a lineup is to be duped. I have experimented with product ownership on high dupe sports, MMA, Showdown, things like that in the past as a way to kind of give me another angle of calculating dupes and assessing dupes. It's been a long time since I've used that, frankly, because our field lineups have gotten so good at calculating dupes themselves. The field lineups that are in the contest sim for high dupe sports have just gotten extremely sharp. We actually just did a big update to that. Let's see. Ownership recently. And Eric came on here. Oh, not ownership. What's the search term? Probably indicative of the fact that this video is not titled well, if I can't find it here on the show. Field lineups? I just saw it. Let's see. Where did we do this? There it is. I don't know why that didn't show up, because I searched ownership and I searched field lineups and it didn't pop up. But this video, 22 minutes long, Eric's kind of breaking down how we improve the field lineups to better assess dupes. This model update, I think, basically made ownership, product, and geomean unnecessary for the most part, just because our dupe predictions are just straight up better than that way of predicting dupes now. I have never, ever used a sum ownership rule in a build on SaberSim ever. I am not kidding. Never once. I have never set that rule. I think SaberScore's approach to using adjusted ownership as a negative weighting factor in your lineups is better than an ownership max, a cap sum. And I think the contest sims simmed against field lineups is far better than an ownership sum cap. An ownership sum cap is just a very, very brute force rule. Most of the people that are saying to, you know, set certain ownership caps are just like creating a fairly basic heuristic by looking at like teams that won GBPs and things like that. It's pretty unrefined. In practice, you really have this balance of lineup upside and ownership, and it is a bit of a sliding scale between those things, right? Like a lineup that has a lot of ownership needs to kind of pay its way towards being a good lineup by being remarkably well projected. And a lineup that has very low ownership has a lower projection floor that it needs to hit. So an ownership cap just doesn't do a good job of understanding the relationship between those two things. It's just hard capping it. So not a fan on my end. So I honestly don't use these things. So, I don't have good advice at this point on how I would use them, certainly not together. So, cool. Let's keep it going here. Quick one here. Hopefully they're never quick with me, right? I tend to ramble, but, if I'm playing 25 lineups, should I put 25 into the number of lineups box? Yes, you should. So when you're building, you open up your build. Number of lineups, that would be 25. This other number, pool size, that is the total number of lineups we are building for you. If you are on the pro or ultimate plan, just leave it at 5,000. That is the maximum number you can build. If you are on the standard plan, the maximum number is 500. You just want this number as big as it can go. The more lineups you build, the more flexible your pool is. The more accurately we'll identify the best lineups for you to play, and the more diversified you can get with things like min uniques. So, but this number is like the number of lineups you're playing, the number of lineups you need out of that build to enter into contests is what this number should be. All right. Okay. We're hopping over to YouTube chat here. Bill, profit plan question. Let's say you reached a point of playing $1,000 a night for MLB for the elevator contest. Would you still enter a contest like the $5 three max that pays $400 to first? I guess the question is, would you still enter contests from lowest to highest, even if the lowest contest has a first place payout less than what you're playing for the slate? So that funny, it's funny how you wrote this. That is literally the rule that I use to determine if I'm going to play a contest. So no, I don't. I generally tend to not play contests if their first place prize is not what I'm playing for the slate. That is like actually like the word for word rule that I use to determine if I'm entering a contest. So if I'm playing $1,000, the minimum first place prize that I'm going to play for any contest must be $1,000. That is the way that I typically tend to decide what contests I'm going to play. If you had an enormously large bankroll, I think you could ultimately end up reintroducing those contests back in later and then do exactly what you said in this next message here. Just play a lineup that you're playing elsewhere into those. So this ends up becoming a very popular question during football season because there are infinite dime times that get opened up or whatever they're called for football season, where they're like $40 to first. And it's like, following the profit plan, should I enter all 300 dime times that DraftKings opens up over the course of the week? I don't, because I want to make sure that a contest I'm playing pays out at least what I'm playing for the slate to first place. That is my rule of thumb for the profit plan. And I think you also mentioned for elevators, this is true for all of the contests for me. That's not just single entry and three max. For those that are like, what's an elevator contest? We have referred to single entry and three max as elevators in the past, and 20 and 150 max contests as diversifiers, kind of just a way of grouping those two separately in your head of like, what are these contests intended to do in my portfolio? Single entry and three max is to elevate your ROI. 20 max and 150 max is to diversify your portfolio. It's just kind of a way we've talked about these here in the past. So anyway, the rule here is the same for me for both of those contest types. I need at least my stake to first place to play a contest. So yeah, that's my rule. I think last note on that rule could get weird also at very large bankrolls again, because like at some point you're going to reach an inflection point where your action on the slate is so large that it says you shouldn't play a lot of contests, but you can't get the action down unless you play the contests. I think that's kind of an outlier situation, probably something that most of us are not having to worry about. And if you are, I'm sure you already have an alternative there. $1,000 a night or something like that, you're going to be fine following this rule. There's plenty to play that is there. So the one other thing I'll note on this is like, there are some just really good contests out there that it might be worth just making a part of that rotation because they're easy to enter and they're pretty soft. Like, and this really doesn't matter a ton, but like the $1 single entry might be at $500 to first, but it's a dollar and it's like one of the highest ROI contests that you can literally find in contest flashback because it is so soft. It's worth throwing a buck into that contest. I probably don't need to tell you that. You can dupe that contest with a lineup you're playing elsewhere if you're worried about, you know, that lineup being the nuts and only winning $500. Like that's still a pretty decent contest to just throw an entry into, but you don't have to. If I confused you all of a sudden and you're like, wait, you just said the opposite, just listen to what I said first. But anyway. Okay. Brian says, is there a way to make sure I have a certain amount of leverage on the players in my lineup? Yeah, there definitely is. Do I have a build? I do have a build. Okay. So, I mean, we have like right off the bat, we have a leverage column in the app, which will show you your exposure minus the ownership projection, which will basically calculate how much over or under the field you are on a particular player. So very useful right off the bat. The way I kind of recommend using this is once you have built your lineups, the next step that you should follow is, well, if you're on Ultimate, is running a contest sim. If you're not on Ultimate, you'll be sorted by saver score. That's fine. Let's assume we're on Ultimate here, so I can at least show this step. So we've built our lineups. We should create our contest sim for the contest we're playing. And we should run our contest sim. And then we can sort by the contest sim metric. The next step I would highly recommend is to diversify using min uniques, which will force your lineups that you're ultimately taking with you into the contest to be different from one another. That's a important step here to reduce some of your variance here and spread out a little bit. And then I use the leverage column and look at kind of basically what you're getting from there, that kind of contextualizes how much over or under the field you might want to be on your favorite plays. So I will show you an example of this here in just a second. So let's finish this up here. Let's sort by risk-adjusted ROI for the contest sim. And I'm going to also filter lineups that are not profitable. If you've watched the MLB videos on the YouTube channel, you've seen this process probably plenty of times. Now we're going to diversify with min uniques. The way I like to do this is one less than the maximum number I can get while still getting 150 lineups. So let's test like 6 and see if 6 works. 6 does work. Let's test 7. 7 does not work. 6 is our maximum. I'm going to go to 5 min uniques for this slate. Okay. So now let's say we're looking at our pitchers and we're looking at our pitcher leverage. So you can kind of use the leverage column here as a way to see how much over or under the field you are on the field overall, right? So like our two big stands, we're on Cole Reagans, we're on Garrett Crochet. Seen that name a lot this year. I haven't watched enough baseball to know how it's pronounced. So let me know if somebody in the chat knows how that is properly pronounced. But those are our two leverage stands. Fades, on the other hand, are Hunter Brown, Sonny Gray, right? You can use this number here now to determine how much exposure you want to get relative to like these players. So let me give you an example, because this is a little bit hard to contextualize here. So let's say in your research, you think Freddy Peralta is a smash, right? He's up against Washington, decent strikeout upside. You want to be heavy on Freddy Peralta. Well, how much exposure should you get? Well, by default, following this process so far, our top overall exposed player is 33% over the field. Our second is 21% over the field. And everybody else, we're kind of, for the most part, even with the field, for the most part. So where is Freddy Peralta on your pitching scale? Is he your third favorite pitcher? Is he your second favorite pitcher? Is he your first favorite pitcher? If he is your first favorite pitcher, how much exposure should we get? Well, to make him our top exposed pitcher by leverage, we would need more than 33% than the field. So if we go back now and go find for Freddy Peralta, he is 26% owned. If we go to 59% exposure here, he is going to become our top leverage pitcher. Now it's Freddy Peralta there. So you can kind of use the leverage column here as a guidepost. Now, because we've done that, our exposure to these other guys has changed. So he's well over our, he is very much our highest exposed pitcher at this point by leverage. But I still think it's kind of a useful way of thinking about this is like Saberson said, being 33% over the ownership on a given pitcher on this slate makes some sense. So it is a fine way to determine how exposed to be to your favorite pitcher, if that makes sense. That's how I use the leverage column, is it kind of sets the bounds for me. My biggest fade on this slate would probably be, you know, about 10, 15% under the field on any given pitcher based on what we're seeing. And again, this is also, you know, this also depends on how many lineups you're playing by quite a bit. These numbers are going to look different with 150 lineups than they are going to look when you're playing 20 or something like that. But that's how I would use the leverage column. So if you want to have a certain amount of leverage, like, yeah, then set it right there. Like this is exactly how that's calculated. So if you know you want to be 20% over on a player, you can just add 20 to the ownership projection, set it as the min exposure and let it rip. Raj says, last night I was running into issues late swapping Seattle players because there were 3 guys different from the projected lineup. I feel like I did it right, but not sure what I did wrong. Always possible that there was a potential bug or something like that. You can always send in a report in the upper right here. Open this up and then report a problem. Send that in. The support team will take a look at it. I will kind of quickly walk through these steps so that we can see it here and make sure that everybody knows how to do this correctly here. So let's say it is mid-slate, right? And we all of a sudden get news that, let's see, a given player is out. Let's pick somebody that's actually playing in the late games. Corbin Carroll is scratched. All right, this is the first thing that we're looking at. Red lightning bolt. You click this, it's going to tell you who's out. What I would tend to do here is first attempt to swap to the best available player from the same team. If it is a hitter, first of all. If it's a pitcher, just swap best available. But if it's a hitter, swap best from the same team. Click apply, and it'll tell you what swaps happened. When you are in the middle of a slate, you may occasionally see another message here that says Corbin Carroll could not be swapped from two lineups because it's saying there was not a player. This will also especially, this is more likely to happen if it's not a guy like Corbin Carroll, but instead it's a low salary player on the team that gets scratched, because there may not be a replacement player on the same team that fits salary wise. If you see that message, then, so this is already saved, right? This has been saved now since we already hit apply. Then you can click best available and click apply again, and it'll swap the remaining instances of that player. This quick swap tool should virtually always get out players out of your lineups, like 100% of the time. I personally have never seen a situation where quick swap failed to get a player that was in my lineups, that was out and not playing games that night, out of my lineups. If you then go and check DraftKings and you're seeing you still have this player in your lineups, I would say most likely you have a discrepancy between what SaberSim believes are your lineups on DraftKings and what DraftKings says are your lineups. And that can happen for a variety of reasons. If that happens, come back over to the contest tab, click upload entries, download template file from DraftKings, re-upload the new entries file. Whoops, I might have to do it this way. And overwrite. And that puts everything back in sync. But it, like, there, I guess there could be a situation where if it was the very last game of the slate, if you were playing like literally a stone min price hitter and there was not another min priced hitter available on the slate, that it's like, well, you're taking a zero, that like you can't, who's going in? We can't, there's nobody that can go in. But otherwise there is always, almost always, another player with a lower salary that can just be slotted in. And I don't think I've ever ended up in a situation where quick swap fails to find that personally. So I would assume if it is failing on the quick swap side, that it is because of a discrepancy between those two files of what DraftKings thinks is going on and what SaberSim thinks is going on. So Raj says, do you have to set the players at zero or can you just reset the projections and refresh build? No, you don't have to set them at zero. The only thing that has to happen is our like simulation has to run, like the player has to get marked out and the sim has to run on our end for the player to be showing a zero. So if you go and see on the Underdog MLB Twitter and they're like, this guy's scratched, and you come in and check 5 seconds later, it might not be updated yet. But you can like check pretty quickly and see, does the player have the out status? Has their projection gone to zero? If that has happened, the red lightning bolt should be on and you should be good to go. That process does only take a couple minutes. It happens pretty fast. So The next step, that this is kind of part, this is only the first half of the process. You should always be doing that to get these out players out of your lineups, right? And then you avoid taking the zero. The next step you would want to do in the event that a player was scratched or the starting lineups changed is then to run a late swap build, which is going to rebuild your lineups that are in progress, give you a few new options for each of them, and then you can run a contest sim. You could, edit exposures, things like that. You can diversify with min uniques. The late swap build rebuilds your lineups. The quick swap just removes those players from your pool. So, but yeah, I have seen this report come in from people before, and I would say the vast majority of the time it is an issue with an entries file. So, okay. Reed says, if I have run a very low diversity build and the lineups are drastically different than pools, does that become a high diversity build at that point? I am a little confused on what this means. I'm kind of confused on two parts here, Reed. So, like, first, I don't know exactly what you mean. The lineups are drastically different than pools. I also don't know what you mean by a like becoming a high diversity build. I will try to answer this based on what I'm understanding here. First, mentioning that the sim diversity slider, for those that don't know, what this is doing is this is in a pragmatic sense, this is how diverse your pool is, but it comes from how many sims we're looking at per lineup we build. So at 10, we're looking at a single simulation of every game on the slate. At 0, we're looking at every simulation of every game on the slate. And then in between here are different sized buckets of how many sims per lineup. The fewer sims you're looking at, the more high variance your builds are, the more diverse they are, because the impact of an outlier sim is larger on a smaller bucket than it is on a big bucket. So I think what this is saying is if you run a build like down here and your pool exposure looks very different than your lineups exposure, does that become a high diversity build is still a little confusing to me. I don't really think there's anything I'm having a hard time thinking about how a build's diversity would change based on like the results of that build. So I think maybe diversity is being used in two different ways here, like where you're talking about both sim diversity and also the literal like diversity of the build. I don't know. I'm a little lost. So maybe you can give me a little more context there. David says Sosa for the Phillies, not listed in the opto. Yeah, the right place for this is support@sabersim.com, our support email, or the support email or the support channel in our Discord server. The support team will get on that as quickly as they can. I don't even know. Maybe that game started. I might have missed this. But in general, nothing wrong with popping these messages into the YouTube chat here. But streaming live, my ability to troubleshoot and fix things is a little limited. So if you're ever running into an issue with a player projection or a technical issue, support@sabersim.com is always a little bit of a better way to go about getting that fixed than on office hours. We can always do like answer these kinds of questions, you know, the next day of like, hey, I was running into some issues trying to do this here. And we can walk through the steps, but I can't fix the Phillies lineup on the live stream. So Summer League NBA Sims, almost certainly not, like 99% no. They will, the slates will probably be in the app. I think that requires a little bit of setup on our end. Oh, nope, they're there. So you can upload custom projections, but we will not have sims. Reed then also said, also, does late swap have the same effect on the basic plan or just ultimate live data, the sim ROI plan? Yeah, so this is going back to the late swap conversation we were having earlier here. Does it still have the same effect? It will be less of an effect. Because the contest sims in late swap are going to find contest sims when late swapping are going to be more intentional and almost greedy about seeking ROI in that moment in time in the slate for each individual lineup. A contest sim is going to understand that a lineup that is underperforming needs to take on additional risk to win back additional equity. The Saber scores that are used at late swap will not understand that. They will be a little bit more late swaps using Saber score and not using contest sims will kind of more generically swap lineups into good plays. It will not have an understanding of where that lineup's current position is in the contest. So it will have less of an effect. That the effect we were talking about before, where you're kind of thinking about ROI, pre-lock, and mid-slate differently, that will be diminished. That effect will not be as significant in late swap. That isn't to say like that it is much worse for that, right? Like late swaps using Saber score are still going to be very effective at adjusting for changing starting lineups, for player scratches, things like that. It's just not going to be dynamically making the highest ROI swap per lineup like a contest sim would. So. John says, can you briefly explain percentiles? I certainly can. There are two different percentiles you will see in the app. One is quite a bit more exposed than the other. They are player percentiles and lineup percentiles. They are the same mathematical thing, just on different objects, I guess. The player percentile is kind of a way of visualizing a player's range of outcomes. So Sonny Gray, 19.38 projected points on average, right? If we click into this player, it will load a distribution, at least in theory. I've been having a little bit of trouble with these distributions lately. Sometimes they seem to load, sometimes they don't, and I don't know why. Let's see. Let me try to refresh one sec, because it will really help with this point if I can pull up the player distribution. There it is. Okay. So 19.38 points is the average across the full range of outcomes. Every sim we have, this is the average outcome. The percentiles are kind of like breakpoint milestones of that distribution. So when we say Sonny Gray's 25th percentile outcome is 12.5 points, that means Sonny Gray scores more than 12.5 points 75% of the time. He scores less than that 25% of the time. That is his 25th percentile outcome. Most of the time, I think when you are actually like using these for something, you'll be thinking more about it from the upside. So the 95th percentile outcome is a lot of times what I think about as a player's like true achievable ceiling. 99th percentile happens 1% of the time or less. So it's like an extreme ceiling outcome. 95th percentile outcome is kind of what I think of as like that player's functional ceiling on the slate. So we're saying Sonny Gray will hit 35.7 DraftKings points about 5% of the time on this slate. And those are just, these are just coming directly from the Sims. The 50th percentile outcome is the median score. So half of the outcomes in the Sims are above that, half are below that. You will see a discrepancy in this number between this and the mean projection because they are measuring slightly different things. The median that you see as the 50th percentile outcome is an actual achievable score, first of all. It is the middle outcome. So again, Sonny Gray could score 19.8 points on the slate tonight. And in fact, that is the outcome where we think half of the outcomes are above that, half of the outcomes are below that. There is no scoring outcome where Sonny Gray could actually score 19.38 points. This is a mean. This number is calculated by taking the total fantasy points he scored in every single sim we have and dividing it by the number of simulations run, which is why this is not a actual scorable number, but this number is. That is what the percentiles do. The other percentiles you will see, or you can see, is a lineup percentile. Where you are most likely to see that is if you go digging into the Saber scores here, you will see a lineup percentile. So if you are sorting your lineups by Saber score in the app, a part of that ranking is the 99th percentile of the lineup's performance. It works a very similar way to it is the same mathematical thing as the player percentiles here, but in this case, it's at the lineup level. So this lineup, I think we can actually show the lineup percentiles here. We might need to make a custom metric, add a metric. Yeah, 99th percentile value. So this lineup's 99th percentile outcome is 190.86 points. So in our simulations, this lineup scores 190.86 points 1% of the time, or it scores that or higher 1% of the time. So those are percentiles. You did say briefly. I don't know if that qualifies as brief, but hopefully it was at least well explained. So, Chuck, with the change to ROI and win rate, with the change to how ROI and win rate are calculated in beta, does it matter what the number of lineups is in the My Lineups box, or does it consider the whole pool as the portfolio? So this is getting a little into the behind the curtain stuff. I don't know, to be honest. From a practical standpoint, you should just put the number of lineups that you're playing into the lineups box. Like, that's how it should be used. I don't know how the math is done on the back end there, personally. And I don't think that information is going to be revealed because this is this new algorithm, I guess, here was worked on very hard. And with how popular contest sims are nowadays, and there are many different contest sims out there, this particular detail we want to keep a little bit under wraps here because we think it is very valuable the way that it was put together. So I actually don't even know the answer to that. I don't think the answer to that will be made public in terms of how the portfolio side of things is being calculated. But practically speaking, your number of line, you should not be changing the number of lineups that you enter into that box because of the way that this system now works. It was built assuming that a player puts the number of lineups they need into that box. So, yeah, and Raj, I don't necessarily want to give the impression that this was certainly something you did wrong. It is possible there was a bug here that took place that I'm maybe not aware of. A report probably wouldn't hurt. I would say more than likely, though, it was a discrepancy with the entries file, which, again, it happens all the time. So no worries there. But yeah, the only other thing I'll mention calling back to that swap one more time here is the quick swaps are going to listen to other settings that you have set. So they do listen to your player pool. They do listen to your custom projections. They do listen to your min salary settings. So if you are really under the gun and it just like appears to not be working and you have uploaded a fresh entries file, I would double check that you have not limited your pool significantly by adding and removing players. I would check that your min salary maybe is just set to zero, so it is not unnecessarily restrictive when you're just trying to get an out player out of your lineup. And I would maybe, if you're very much under the gun and you're trying to just get out players out quickly, I would just consider a like total hard reset of all of your player projections and going back to SaberSim defaults. So at least you're not taking zeros. So okay, so I think some follow-up from Reed here on this other question. The lineup exposure is very different from the pool exposure. I would assume the pool exposure is a representation of a low diversity build. Say if Cleveland was chalk and the pool has very high Cleveland, but the lineup build has no Cleveland, what does that mean? Yeah, so I get what you're saying. So yeah, and this is something you may notice independently of, like, this is independent of the diversity slider. This is just something you may notice about your builds, right? And you will notice this in particular at very low min unique settings. So if we take this build, for example, which has kind of been the working build we've been using here from the start of this stream here, right? And we look at our top exposure, you're going to see discrepancies here quickly in the pool exposure versus the lineup exposure, right? Cole Reagan's 30% of our pool, 88% of our top lineups. And a lot of that is because, like, whether you're using a contest SAM or you're using SaberScore, there are going to be plays on the slate that SaberSim believes are very good plays. And they're going to get jammed into all of the top lineups, right? Like, if this, what this sort is saying is sort ROI highest to lowest. So if we believe that Cole Reagan's is one of the best plays on the slate, there, you can only play two pitchers, right? It's going to find a lot of Cole Reagan's lineups in the top, right? Because he's a very high ROI individual player, I guess, is essentially what that's saying. When you do things like diversify with min uniques, that effect starts to be a little bit more diminished. And what you will often find is that the cost of that in terms of your ROI or your Saber score is often very low. And that is why we diversify. So if we're at one min unique, our lowest ROI is 42%. Our average ROI is 60.6%. When we go to, you know, let's say four min uniques, our min ROI is 37.2. Our average is 53.6. We have costed ourselves not very much to mitigate risk, essentially, on that. This is like essentially the balancing act. I'm oversimplifying here the way that min uniques kind of diversifies you and the effect of that. But we are making an intentional ROI trade-off to diversify and take on less individual player risk. Among other things, the min uniques also helps to avoid a situation where your lineups cannibalize each other's EV, which is something that is kind of fixed on beta as well. They also, the min uniques also serves to, lost my train of thought, I'm sorry. The min uniques also serves to mitigate the biases that may be showing up in the sims. If we are over projecting a player or under projecting their ownership or something like that, having been diversified mitigates like some input risk, some bias risk that can come up as well. I wouldn't say pool exposure is representative of a low diversity build, because all of the lineups built in your pool are built at the diversity setting you've chosen. And if you will see different types, you will see different numbers in your pool as you change the diversity settings. So really what this question is about is, like, just at least the way I'm understanding it, discrepancies between your top X lineups versus the entire pool. And the main explanation for that is because the sorting method with no additional diversification applied is greedy in the way that it searches out players and finds players. You are like brute forcing the answer here of saying, like, I want the top 150 lineups out of my 5,000 by this method. And SaberSim's going to say, well, 132 of them are this player, even though only 30% of that player appears in the pool. Those lineups are very likely good, and they're going to be kind of like greedily seeked out by the sorting method. So, Raj, for a site like Yahoo or Owner's Box, if you create your own contest sim and run it, does that still work? Yeah, it does. So Yahoo and Owner's Box, you have to do that. For Yahoo and Owner's Box, you have to do that. For FanDuel, you will see, FanDuel's a little weird too, if I remember correctly. There's like something. So on FanDuel, we generalize the payout structures, and I think even the contest sizes. I think both of these are generalized, like based on what they tend to be, if I remember correct. Like you may sometimes see slight discrepancies of what these actually are versus what the contest is. So you can just double check that. We have like a more direct connection to DraftKings and are actually pulling in the real data there. FanDuel, we're kind of generalizing. Yahoo and Owner's Box, you won't see those contests there at all. We're not pulling in contest data from them at all. But yes, you can, if you were building for Yahoo tonight, for example, you can just configure the contest sim for yourself in the contest sim settings and just calculate these things for yourself, right? So percent to first is just first place prize divided by the prize pool. For percent to entries paid, just look at the payout structure, find the bottom min cash spot. So if it's, 150 out of 400 is the last min cash spot, 150 divided by 400 is your percent of entries paid. These are always expressed as whole numbers, they're expressed as percentages, not as decimals on SaberSim. So remember that. Like you don't want to say 0.25, you want to say 25%. But yeah, you can just configure this. We also don't have the contest field lineup buckets for Yahoo and Owner's Box. So you'll just have to use the ownership field lineups, which again should work okay. But Samuel, I appreciate it. That is I feel like the exact same way. Especially on the ultimate plan, but regardless, I mean the ultimate plan is relatively new and I've been clearly using SaberSim for years here, but that I think the most valuable part of our tool is it enables you to play DFS in the way that you want to play. Especially again using the contest sims that came out this past year and running your build, running your contest sim, diversifying with min uniques, filtering out the bad lineups. I've never felt more confident and enabled to take stands because I can just see the impact that that has on my lineups and know that I'm still playing lineups that the Sims think are good. Like if I have done more ball knower type takes this past year than I've ever done in DFS ever, because I feel like I have so much confidence in being able to do that and know that I'm playing lineups that still grade out well. So I think you said it well there. For min salary, leaving it blank is the same as putting zero on it. Ooh, I don't know. Honestly, it shouldn't really accept blank. It's not great that it does, to be honest. So I would put zero. If you intend to put zero, I would put zero. I think that field should highlight itself in red and probably disable the build lineups button if it were left blank, but it doesn't. So a little bit of like a weird UI thing there, but just enter a number in there. You could probably test it. You may very well be right. I just don't want you to end up messing up on accident there. All right. We are all caught up on questions. We are 1 hour and 8 minutes in here. So we've done pretty well. Any other questions for me today? There will not be a office hours tomorrow. I know Andrew normally does the Saturday matinee, as I like to call it, the 11 a.m. Eastern. He is still on vacation. I won't be able to make that show tomorrow, so we're going to punt the Saturday show here, and then we will be back on Monday. Andrew will be back on Monday, so you can come hang out with him, and I suppose we're about there. to leave it there today. Raj says MLB All-Star break next week. Yeah, a couple breaks next week, right? I think WNBA goes on its like month-long break as well. Came up quick this year. The summer is just flying by. I can't believe it is already the All-Star break here. So, but it starts on Monday, right? Like I think Sunday is the last day before the break. I think it does. If I remember correctly, I think like the All-Star game itself is on Monday or something. But I could be wrong. I get these things mixed up all the time. So, all right, folks. Well, I think we're going to cap it off there. I don't see any other last minute questions trickling in. So good luck to everyone's slates they are playing today and this weekend. One more question from Ryan. Ryan, you came in right at the perfect time here. I'm currently getting about $50 down on MLB slates with 25 going to MME quarter and solo shot. The rest going to single entry, three max, $1, $3, $5 single entry, and then the $1, $3, and the $3, three max. Anything you would change, it just seemed viable. Ryan, this seems perfect. This sounds like somebody that watched the DFS profit plan video and got it. Looks great. I would say you can adjust those ratios as you get a little more familiar with what game types you prefer. You may find that you prefer playing contests that are more single entry three max. I think what you are playing right now implies to me that you enjoy single entry three max a little more. You could flex that to be more like 25% goes to single entry and three max and 75% goes to multi-entry, which is a little more what I do because I like playing a ton of lineups. And I'm an MME truther. I just am. I can't help it, but this is perfect. This is fine. There's nothing wrong with this. This looks good. So, all right, cool. Let's see. Last thought I want to mention. If you haven't popped onto the YouTube channel here recently and watched some of the recent videos we've put out, it is kind of funny seeing my face like plastered all over this here, a little awkward, but been working really hard on this content this year. We're working with a new editing team, a new production team here. So the quality of our week to week videos here is much higher. We're putting a lot more work into the scripting of the content and then the like proofreading of that script, the final recording, adding in graphics and visual elements to make it more clear what I'm talking about here. Just a lot of work to upgrade the quality of these videos here. So I would check them out if you haven't been watching some of the more recent stuff, especially, you know, if you're trying to improve your baseball DFS strategy, or particularly if you're new to baseball. There's a lot to talk about here. There's late swap, there's weather. The golf videos too, like there's other videos besides baseball showing up here. But definitely check those out if you are, whether you're new, whether you're familiar with baseball. I think they're good as refreshers. What is probably my favorite video I've actually done this summer is almost finished up as of today. I think it's possible that it ends up going live today. If not, maybe this weekend, maybe very early next week. It is like my top five tips for baseball DFS in 2024, like with how I perceive the games to be this year. These are the things that I think are most important and most useful to incorporate and think about into your process. So I'm very, very happy with the way that this video is turning out and very excited for it to get out there. So stay tuned for that here as well. Hopefully coming out maybe in the next like 48, 72 hours, maybe 24 hours if we're lucky. So. Ryan says, sweet. I recently moved up in stakes. I'm struggling to get more MME action that isn't the dimes. Minimax doesn't seem like a viable contest for me. Yeah. I mean, it can be tough. I'll kind of like show one thing that has been annoying me, and I promise we are aware of it and we are working on it, is we're not processing the Minimax well in Flashback lately. So we don't have like the sim ROIs showing up. Oh, we do. Hey, wait, that's not a very good number. I should look at that. I didn't play very well yesterday. Oh no, this isn't right. Cause it's pulling me up as the only 150 maxer. Yeah. Something's still not right here. Yeah. I don't know. What I was going to say though, is if you actually look at the Minimax, what you will see is the like highest sim ROIs that you can get in this contest are a little bit lower than other contests out there. But the sim median profit is generally less negative than it is in other contests. And really what it's saying is that, like, yes, this is a harder contest to have a sky high 30% ROI or something like that in over the long term, but it is a safer contest to play as a way to get access to profit while not taking on a lot of risk. And that is, like, literally what a diversifier contest is. When we talk about elevators versus diversifiers, that is the literal definition of what a diversifier is supposed to do. And so I think the Minimax gets a little bit of a bad rap. I think it does. Where, like, you certainly don't have to play it, right? The profit plan is not intended to make you play contests that you have no interest in playing and don't want to, right? It's your money, it's your portfolio, do what you want with it. But I do think it gets a little bit of a bad rap. Because I think it's got a very nice payout structure for a 150 max low stakes tournament. It has a decent min cash line. It pays 2x to min cash. It is 10% to first. So you're not just getting rake washed and playing like 4% to first contests or anything like that. You can play it as a way to get access to potential upside while having smaller swings. And I apologize that it is not contest simming well lately. I don't know what's going on with that. Actually, I do. I don't know why I said I don't know what's going on. We know what's going on with that, and we are working on a fix. So I don't know. So that should be fixed soon. I know that's been annoying. But okay. Anyway, I do need to call it there. I've got to run. Everybody, good luck in your contests again today, this weekend. Have a good weekend. Try to stay cool if you are experiencing the same heat wave that we are out here. And otherwise, Andrew will be back on office hours, 4:00 Eastern on Monday. Thanks again, everybody. See ya.